for us. From time to time, I'll have folks that will come up to me and say, you know, I pray for you every day. You'll never know what that means. For I'm convinced that sermon after sermon, class after class, day after day, I'm buoyed by the prayers of God's people. I think if you talk to Gary or Wendell or Rusty or Carmack, I think if you talk to our elders, they'd tell you the same thing. Thank you for praying for us. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you for forgiving us and believing in us. This afternoon, we went over to Bedford County to my aunt and uncle's home. Buddy and Janelle brothers, that's my dad's oldest brother. My dad is the middle of five kids. Got one girl and four boys. And so you know what a rough life she had. Fortunately, she was the oldest in the bunch, and so could hopefully try her best she could to straighten out those four boys. But she said she did the best she could, but didn't succeed. We enjoyed being together as a family. We had a big potluck meal, and everybody brought food. And then afterwards, we took a big family picture. Then the kids had an Easter egg hunt out in the front yard, and it was fun seeing all the grandkids and the great-grandkids running around in the front yard playing. And I remember standing there with my cousins thinking about days many, many years ago when we were running around in the front yard over at my grandmother's place and finding Easter eggs. And now here are our kids and their kids, for that matter, running around or being carried around by their moms when they're too small to do so, finding Easter eggs. I believe there's a relationship between that and what I want us to talk about tonight, and I'll come back to that in just a few moments. If you would, open your Bibles to the book of Ezekiel. In Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 2, it says, "On the fifth of the month, in the fifth year of Jehoiachin's exile, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest." Ezekiel is a fascinating book. And visiting with us, we're continuing our focus on sermons from. And so tonight we're looking at a sermon from Ezekiel. We've looked at Isaiah and Jeremiah and Lamentations. As we look tonight for a few moments at the book of Ezekiel, there are a lot of similarities between what we've looked at and what we're looking at. Ezekiel was born somewhere around 622 B.C. during the reign of the good King Josiah. He was a prophet during the last five kings of Israel. By and large, other than Josiah, that was a very, very bad time. Most of those kings were trying to stabilize the nation of Judah during troubled times. But as we've mentioned before, they tried to stabilize the kingdom, not by trusting in God and walking in His ways, but by trying to pick which powerhouse politically they were going to make an allegiance with. Generally, it was Egypt. And so these kings are not paying much attention or any attention to God, and they're trying to see who's the biggest bully on the block and decide who they're going to side with. And ultimately, their ruin would come. As we think about Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and Daniel all prophesy at the same time. Ezekiel grew up with Daniel. Ezekiel grew up listening to the prophesying and preaching of Jeremiah. A very important world event happened in 612 B.C. when the mighty Assyrian Empire, remember, in 722 B.C., and again, B.C. counts downward as it gets closer to us, and A.D. counts upward as it gets closer to us. But in 722 B.C., the Assyrian Empire was the empire that destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel. They defeated Samaria. Shalmaneser and Sargon the Great did that. And you would have thought at that time, you know, this was a nation that would never fall. And so for well over another 100 years, they would be the powerhouse, the bully on the block, if you will. And then something shocking in world history and politics happened when in 612 B.C., the Assyrians were defeated by the Babylonians. And the Babylonians became the major powerhouse in the ancient world. In 605 B.C., the Assyrians attacked, the Babylonians attacked Jerusalem. The young 18-year-old king of Jerusalem didn't want to see a bloodbath, and so he and the leaders of the city surrendered themselves to the enemy to keep the Babylonians from wiping out the city. I thought, and personally, it showed tremendous nobility and love for the people. In the opposite of that, Zedekiah, who was the last king of Judah, when his city was surrounded, he and his leading officials snuck out of the city by night. And I want you to see the difference in those two kings. And so when the king surrendered himself, the Babylonians took about 10,000 of the most important, most influential, powerful, and the wealthiest people of the city and the kingdom and took them back to Babylon. That was kind of the Babylonian philosophy. The Assyrians, their philosophy was to kill everybody who could have influence. The Babylonian philosophy was you took everybody of influence and you took them back to Babylon and you re-educated them and integrated them into your new government. And so that's what had happened in 605 B.C. Daniel was taken during that deportation. So Daniel goes back or goes to Babylon in 605 B.C. In 597 B.C., you have another attack upon Jerusalem, and this time you have about 3,000 who are taken back to Babylon. And when these 3,000 are taken to Babylon, among them is a young 25-year-old man named Zedekiah. Jeremiah was a priest, and Zedekiah was a priest. So I want you to kind of try to piece all this together. 605, Daniel is taken along with the leading young men back to Babylon, or to Babylon. In 597, Ezekiel is taken as a captive to Babylon. The city of Jerusalem is destroyed in 586 B.C. Jeremiah is offered the opportunity to go to Babylon, but he chooses to stay behind with the few people who are left. These are the very, very poorest of the people. Because you've already had two exiles to Babylon, in which each time they've taken the best and brightest, if you will, the wealthiest and most powerful. And so all you have left are the poorest of the people of their land. And Jeremiah chose to stay with them. And so you end up with a situation where you have Daniel, who basically becomes the prophet of the kings, the prophet of royalty. He would speak and guide kings, even in changing empires. When the Medes and Persians took over the Babylonian Empire, Daniel would still have prominence and his prophecies would still be heard echoing through the halls of Babylon. You then have Jeremiah who stays back home and he prophesies to the poor who are left behind. And finally, he's taken off to Egypt and dies there. And then you have Ezekiel. Ezekiel is taken to Babylon, and about 5 years after he's taken away, somewhere around 593, thereabouts, somewhere 4 to 5 years after he is taken into captivity, God begins to speak to him. And they can do a pretty good job of dating these visions because 13 dates are found in the book of Ezekiel. And we know that his prophecies go from roughly about 593 B.C., down to about 571 B.C. is the dating we have, somewhere thereabout, of the last of his prophecies in the book of Ezekiel. So he would prophesy for about 22 years. And he would prophesy to people in exile. In other words, sometimes you would have a prophet who is prophesying to the children of Israel, warning them that the fall of the city is coming, the fall of the kingdom is coming, the exile is coming. But sometimes you have prophets who prophesy in the aftermath of that coming. For example, Jeremiah would continue to work among the people after the city of Jerusalem was taken over by the Babylonians. But he did that in Jerusalem with the ones left behind. So what is unique about Ezekiel is that Ezekiel is prophesying to the Israelites who were taken away into exile. The Son of Man is a common phrase that's found in this book. 93 times the phrase Son of Man is found. And if you'll look at the ministry of Jesus, you'll find that Son of Man comes to be Jesus' favorite phrase to describe Himself. I think you find it over 30 times just in the book of Matthew alone. Now, He's probably primarily drawing from a reference in the book of Daniel. But it's significant in our book that Son of Man is this common phrase connected with Ezekiel, His person, and His prophecy, and that that would later become the common phrase Jesus wanted Himself known by. And so there, I just want to say there are a lot of echoes of Jesus and His life and His ministry found in the book of Ezekiel. Let's look at the book of Ezekiel. One key thing that jumps out is found in Ezekiel chapter 18. You know, most of the prophets emphasize the corporate nature of the people. One of the things that's hard for us to relate to, because we live in a very individualistic society, it's hard for us to relate to corporate responsibility and this community sharedness. When we look in the Old Testament, generally speaking, the nation rejoiced together, they suffered together. They won together, they lost together. And many times when one part of them sinned, they all ended up being somehow caught up in the punishment that came from it. So you have this corporate sense of it, that this is a people of God, that we're not all a bunch of individuals, but that we work together and that we have a responsibility to the group. And we have a responsibility not only to do right ourselves, but to make sure the whole group does what is right. What is unique about Ezekiel is, unlike the other prophets, he doesn't stress this corporate, this big picture, what the whole nation is suffering and what the whole nation is doing, but rather he focuses more on the individual, the individual responsibility. And he emphasizes that a person is saved or lost not based on what their parents do or their children do or even what the whole nation does. Their relationship with God lies in their personal choices, their personal decisions. In Ezekiel chapter 18, in verse 20, he says, "The person who sins will die." Ezekiel 18:20. "The son will not bear the punishment of the father's iniquity, nor will the father bear the punishment of the son's iniquity. The righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself. But if the wicked man turns from all his sins which he has committed, and observe my statutes and practices, justice and righteousness, he shall surely live. He shall not die." And what he's basically going to go on and say in verses 23 and following is, he says, if the man of God, the man of righteousness, leaves that righteousness and begins to do iniquity, it says all his good deeds shall be forgotten and he'll face the punishment of the Lord. But he also goes on to say in verse 27, again, when a wicked man turns away from his wickedness which he has committed and practices justice and righteousness, he will save his life. The point is, he says that the sons will stand before God not based on what the fathers did, but on what they actually do. And the fathers will stand before God not based on what their children do, but based upon what they do. And the person who is righteous before God, if they turn from their ways, then they'll be held accountable. Likewise, the person who is living unrighteously, if they'll turn from their unrighteous ways and come back to God, He'll forgive them and He'll take them back. You see, there seems to have been this mentality that said, hey, we're in this mess because of our parents. It's because of what our fathers did. That's why the Babylonians are a danger to us. That's why the exile is coming. And Ezekiel says, no, you are responsible for your own deeds and your own actions. And it may have been that they thought kind of this idea that you can pile up and hold on to good things done in the past. You know, on the one hand, it's either our parents' fault we got here, or on the other hand, we can kind of ride our parents' coattails, and even our own coattails, our nation's coattails. In other words, we're God's people. We've done good stuff in the past. Our forefathers did good things, so we'll be okay. And there was this mentality that you know, we're God's people in God's city, and there's God's temple. Nothing bad can ever really happen to us. He says, no. No matter what's been done in the past, either good or bad, you can't ride on the coattails of the successes of the past, and you can't blame your parents for the mistakes of the past. That each of us will be held accountable for our own actions. And I wonder how many people have thought, you know, I can never be a child of God because my dad was an alcoholic and beat my mother. Or maybe you might say, my mom was a drug user. Or my parents never were faithful to God. And so we live with this baggage of feeling like God can't love me. I can't overcome my heritage. Maybe we live that way. To that person, Ezekiel says, I'm not looking at what your parents have done. I'm looking at you when it comes to our relationship. I'll look at them when it comes to my relationship with them. But I don't look at you in light of your parents. And likewise, I wonder how many folks are thinking, okay, well, my mom and my dad, you know, they're Bible class teachers, or my dad's an elder, or my dad's a deacon, and, you know, my mom heads up this group, or whatever it is that our parents may have done or be doing in the Lord's church. And we almost kind of think like we get to be grandchildren of God. Like we don't have to really get involved and be really committed, that somehow we're going to kind of get to go to heaven because our parents are real committed. You know, I've even known of spouses that thought, well, you know, my wife comes regularly, so that kind of makes it okay. She kind of goes on behalf of the family. Ezekiel says that's all wrong. It's about my life and my choices. And I individually am responsible for the choices that I make. I can't blame my parents, and I can't go to heaven on the coattails of my parents. I can only get there by the grace of God and my personal choice to accept that grace, to live in that grace, and to seek God's forgiveness when I fall away from being faithful to that grace. But not only does he emphasize individual responsibility, a tremendous emphasis is found in verse 28 of chapter 1. And this is going to tie into a theme that I've been emphasizing all through our study of Genesis, Exodus, and sermons from the Old Testament. In verse 28 of Ezekiel chapter 1, it says, as the appearance of the rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the surrounding radiance. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face and heard a voice speaking. The word glory is found 23 times in the book of Ezekiel. It is a key phrase. In fact, it's not only a key phrase in this book, it's a key phrase throughout the Old Testament. It was a word that was used to describe the greatness, the majesty, the preeminence, the holiness, the presence of God. Over and over you have this reference to the glory of the Lord, and you're going to see that repeatedly in the book of Ezekiel. I'm reminded of what we talked about when we were going through Exodus. Remember, what was it in Exodus chapter 33? What was it that God showed Moses? His glory. Remember, he said, you cannot look directly at me, but he says, my glory shall pass before you. And he put him in the cleft in the rock, and he covered him up as he passed by. And Moses, so to speak, saw the back of his glory. Remember when we studied from Isaiah. We had a sermon this last year from Isaiah chapter 6. And remember in Isaiah chapter 6, what did Isaiah say he saw? He said, I saw the Lord on the throne, high and exalted. His glory filled the temple. And when Isaiah saw the glory and majesty of God, Isaiah was struck with his own unworthiness and said, I'm a man of unclean lips in the midst of a people of unclean lips. I have no right to be here. When God wanted a prophet to help the people to understand the significance of the presence of God, God tended to put that prophet in the presence of God so that he knew experientially exactly what he was talking about. In the book of Ezekiel, there are 65 times that you have variations of this phrase, thus they will know that I am the Lord. They didn't know the Lord anymore. And God wanted them to know that He is Lord, that He is Yahweh, that He is their God, that He is the God of all that is. And so as he chose his man who was going to speak to those who were in exile because they didn't know God anymore, he gave that man, Ezekiel, a vision of God, and it says that Ezekiel fell on his face. He had that same feeling of overwhelming unworthiness that Isaiah had. And then once he had felt that feeling, God gave him a series of visions, many of them involving the glory of the Lord. I want you to turn with me to Ezekiel chapter 10. I have referred to these previously, but we've not read them. In Ezekiel chapter 10 and verse 4, "Then the glory of the Lord went up from the cherub to the threshold of the temple. And the temple was filled with the cloud, and the court was filled with the righteousness of the glory of the Lord." In verse 18 of chapter 10, "Then the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. And when the cherubim departed, they lifted up their wings and rose up from the earth in my sight with the wheels beside them. And they stood still at the entrance of the east gate of the Lord's house. And the glory of the Lord of Israel hovered above them." In chapter 11, it says, "The Spirit lifted up and brought me to the east gate, to the Lord's house which faced eastward." In chapter 11 then, in verse 22, it says, "Then the cherubim lifted up their wings with the wheels beside them, and the glory of the God of Israel hovered over them. And the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city and stood over the mountain which was on the east side of the city. And the Spirit lifted me up and brought me in a vision to the Spirit of God, by the Spirit of God, to the exiles in Chaldea. So the vision I had seen left me, and then I told the exiles all the things that the Lord had shown me." In other words, in chapter 1, he says, "God gave me a vision of His glory, and I fell on my face in awe." But then in chapter 10, he speaks of another vision that God gave him of that same glory. But now God has taken him. He's in that vision, teleported, if you will, Ezekiel from Babylon, until Ezekiel literally sees the city of Jerusalem of his youth and finds himself in the tabernacle, or at this time, the temple. And he says he's at the temple, and he sees this magnificent throne chariot with cherubim. And God is enthroned and hovering above these cherubim and this throne chariot with its wheels. And he says he beheld as God's glory left the most holy place and went to the threshold of the door of the temple. And then he says the glory of God left the threshold of the temple and went to the gate on the eastern side of the city. And then it says, then God's glory and His great throne chariot went to the hill of Zion near the Mount of Olives on the eastern side of the city and looked down on the city. And with each of those visions, Ezekiel is taken with them as they travel, until finally they get up on the city and the glory of the Lord has departed from the holy place. He's departed from the city and he's looking down on the city, and then the vision ends. And what's interesting is as you read the description there, it's almost as if God lingered at every place. You ever been somewhere and you didn't want to go home? You ever been on one of those vacations, it was just wonderful? You know, sometimes you go on vacation and you say, "Oh, this is nice, this is good, but I'm ready to go home." But then every once in a while it's just so incredible or so wonderful and you have such memories, I'm not ready to go. Or maybe you go to visit some loved ones during the holidays, some folks you haven't seen in a long time, or you go to see some dear friends from days gone by, and you have such a wonderful time together, you just don't want it to end. So you pause and talk several times on the way from the house out to the car, clinging to every precious moment. It's hard to say goodbye to that which you love. And the imagery, it seems to me, is of a God who's been run out of the city. The people have forgotten Him. They've taken Him for granted. And so God has to leave. They no longer honor His holiness. They no longer treasure His glory. God lingers at the threshold. And then He lingers at the east gate. And then He lingers on the mountaintop looking down upon the city. But you have this imagery of God's glory leaving the city. And as you look at the book of Ezekiel, it's basically a book about Ezekiel's call and God's judgment on Israel and Judah. And then it says that it deals with God's judgment on the nations. But then it ends with a message of hope. And you can already begin to see that hope there in Ezekiel chapter 11. But I want you to turn with me to Ezekiel chapter 43. In Ezekiel chapter 40, Ezekiel begins to give detailed description of a new temple. In verse 1 of 43, "Then he led me to the gate facing toward the east, and behold, the glory of God of Israel was coming from the way of the east, and his voice was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory." Let me stop there. I want you to think about what it was like emotionally for Ezekiel, who had seen the glory of the Lord, to have this vision of God's glory leaving Jerusalem. I want you to think of what it was like to see God leaving His city. And what it was like then, at the end of chapter 11, for him having come back from that vision, to then walk the streets of Babylon and talk to the Jews about what happened, and telling them, "This happened because we have sinned against God." So thinking of the despair and the emotional heartbreak he felt at watching in that vision God leaving the city, I want you to think about a time when somebody that you've longed to see came back home. You know, every little bit on the news we hear about a soldier or a group of soldiers coming back from Iraq. What do you think it's like for those families standing there on the tarmac or looking through those windows in the waiting area and they see that plane coming in? When they see their loved ones step off of those stairs or come walking out of that tunnel. I want you to think of what it was like for Ezekiel when God gave him a new vision. And in this vision, the glory's coming back. And it says in verse 2, it says, "Behold, the glory of the Lord of Israel was coming from the way of the east." And then in verse 3, it was like the appearance of the vision which I saw, like the vision I saw when he came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the visions I saw by the river Chedar. And I fell on my face. It's exactly what he did in chapter 1. He saw the glory of the Lord and he fell on his face. The glory of the Lord is coming back in his vision. He falls on his face. But this time, it says in verse 4, "And the glory of the Lord came into the house by way of the gate facing toward the east. And the Spirit lifted me up and brought me to the inner court. And behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house." God's back home. What He's saying to the people is, we've taken God's presence for granted. I'm reminded of 1 Samuel chapters 4 and 5, where the children of Israel took for granted the Ark of the Covenant. They thought, "Oh, we can live how we want and take the Ark of the Covenant into battle and we'll always win." They failed to understand it wasn't just about a box, it was about a relationship with the God whose presence was there. And so they lost that battle, and they lost the Ark of the Covenant because they took for granted the presence of the glory of the Lord. And what Ezekiel is saying is, we as a people have taken for granted the presence of the glory of the Lord in the temple. And because we would not follow His ways, but trusted in the Egyptians and other powers, His glory departed. But there will be a new day. And there will be a new temple. And the glory of the Lord is coming back. There is still hope. Remember that message of Ezekiel chapter 18. If those who do unrighteousness will turn from their ways, God will forgive. His glory will return to His people. I'm reminded of what we've mentioned in the past as well. The coming of Jesus, we've talked about from John chapter 1. And I find it interesting in John chapter 1 and verse 14, in talking about Jesus, did you hear what it says of the apostles? "And they beheld His glory." It's doxa. It's the New Testament equivalent of the Hebrew word that's used in Ezekiel. And in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, it's the same word that's used all through Ezekiel for the glory of the Lord. It says, when Jesus came, we beheld His glory. But let me ask you, what did they do? What did humanity do with the presence of the glory of God walking in their midst? They took it for granted, and they nailed Him to a cross, buried Him in a tomb. And then as we've also referred to, in 1 Corinthians 3 in chapter 6, the church is described as the temple of God. And it says in chapter 6, specifically in verses 19 and 20, he says, we are God's temple. And do you remember what Paul says? Therefore what? Glorify Him with your bodies. The glory of God is in our lives. And so our lives ought to be a life of bringing glory to Him. My question this morning is, or this afternoon, this evening, is have we taken His presence for granted? You may say, what might that have to do with the family get-together we had today? We got together today because I've got an uncle that's going back to Iraq. He did a 15-month tour of duty. We prayed for him, and we sent cards and letters, and many people lifted up prayers, as you have for your family members. And he came home, and we were really excited. It's my dad's youngest brother, the youngest of the five kids. But then I got a call this week, said Uncle Miles is going back. You see, when he got back last time, Gary, we just assumed he was here to stay. We just assumed he wouldn't have to go back. I mean, he's in his mid to late 50s. I thought, surely they won't send him back. But he's going back. And so why did we get together as a family, kind of thrown together in the last week? Because we want him to know that we love him, that he's special, and that we're behind him and we'll be behind him just like we were the last time. You know what's sad? It had to take losing him and him going back for us to remember that again. Because I remember the big welcome home party we had when he got there. My point is, are we taking for granted the presence of God in our lives? That we have someone in our lives as Christians who's far more important than any human being, whether it's an uncle, a child, a mom, a dad, brother, sister, husband, and wife. God is in our lives. May we never, ever, ever take that great and precious gift for granted. But understanding that we have the honor of being in the presence of God, His glory in our lives, we have the privilege of living our lives to bring glory to His name. As we look at ourselves tonight, do you have that glory in your life? If you've never put on Jesus Christ in repentance, confession, and baptism, then you do not have the glory of the Lord. For those of us who are Christians, which makes up most of the audience, have we done anything to make the God of glory feel uncomfortable in His temple? And do we need to change as we stand and sing?